some years after the war, I was able to go to Paris quite frequently because I began to work for a French firm there. And we had a factory at a little place called Suresnes, just outside Paris, where Coty had one of his factories, the perfumery factory. And we would leave the chateau in the morning, go to Parc Longchamp racecourse, to the Bois de Boulogne, into Paris, and back at night. Periodically, we would make journeys down into Normandy, and we were able to go to the French Riviera and enjoy some of the pleasures of Deauville. And I well remember on one occasion we came back into Paris and I thought we'd have a look over Notre Dame Cathedral. This we did, and we had the pleasure of seeing for a small fee the jewels of Marie Antoinette that were stored there. But what impressed me very much was a marble . You will appreciate, Mr. Brown, I'm sure, that when you hear my tape, you will realise, of course, that actually I'm speaking completely from memory. I've never at any time made any records or have had any copies made of anything that I might have experienced, but I'm quoting everything as I speak it from memory, and that is the reason why there is at times quite a gap between the spoken words. But I would like to say this, that at Albert, one of the towns in France, there was a church with the statue of the Virgin on the steeple, which was gilded, and at the commencement of the war a shell came over, and although the statue of the Virgin didn't fall, it remained suspended right through the war until towards the end, and the people in the locality, very superstitious naturally, they said that the war will end when the statue of the Virgin falls to the ground. Well, it didn't quite finish up quite like that, but it was rather strange to think that it nearly did happen, because a shell came over and did further damage to it, but it was ultimately taken down by the sappers because it was dangerous. I had many recollections during the war, of course, particularly near Vimy Ridge in France, where, you know, the Canadian troops blew up the ridge. But in this connection, it was quite interesting to note that very often sappers from either side would come in contact or near each other, and one could hear the other mining And we knew that provided we could hear the enemy still picking, that we were safe. But eventually, Jerry, in a very crafty manner, he actually put an automatic pick into the workings. We could hear the pick, and we assumed, of course, that it wouldn't be blown while the men were still working. But ultimately, one of the bright boys noticed that the pick was so automatic that it couldn't possibly have been done by a sapper or a human hand. And as soon as we realized the rhythmic tapping of the automatic pick was around, we made ourselves scarce, because it gave us the opportunity to realize what was about to take place. Another feature of the war as I saw it was that when we were up on the Menin Road at Ypres and the La Bassée Canal, to the east, it was clear that it was impossible to dig trenches there. There was so much water. So they used to put breastworks up, and very often the enemy would lower theirs and let all the water into our workings, which made it extremely difficult and naturally very uncomfortable. But there's not the slightest doubt about it. Being in a London regiment, there was a lot of Cockney humour knocking about. And I well remember at the time in England they were talking about organising money for silver bullets and a campaign to feed the guns, because I can assure you very often we were rationed down to two or three shells a day, because supplies were low, rather at a low ebb at this time. And I will record on one occasion when the enemy themselves, who seemed to have a preponderance of artillery at this time, they were sending over everything at us except the guns themselves. And I will recollect a Cockney hearing these shells coming over. He began to sing the song that went with the campaign: feed the guns, feed the guns, give them all the help they need. And every time a shell came over and burst, he'd pop his head out of the dugout and start off with this song of feeding the guns. It is not difficult for me, as a sergeant, with a lot of men under my command and under my control, I studied the men, and they studied me, and we were a very staunch platoon of men who were for each other, all for all, and not one for one. It was quite exhilarating in a sense, and although of course we realised that we could be in trouble at any time, we had the strength of our own loyalty to each other to inspire us and carry us on. But I must say that when I realised how, as a young, inexperienced, and shall I say naive, young soldier, after 10 days of war being declared, I was in the army, and in retrospect, I realise that thousands and thousands were dodging the column, and those of us who put our lives on the line gladly for what we thought was our country, ultimately we came to realize that it wasn't quite like that at all. And I feel now that I left a comfortable home. My mother was a widow, but she was a lady of good family, and we had a very comfortable home. And I realized I gave all that up to go and join up, and all for a shilling a day. And when I did come home on leave some 2 years later and came into Victoria Station from the boat train, and having our war equipment on, smothered in mud because we came straight from the trenches on leave, when we arrived in Victoria, the commuters, who were sitting pretty and safe in their beds at night, they shunned us as though we were a plague or something of the kind. And I picked up one particular fastidious individual and told him in no uncertain terms that had we not been out there, they wouldn't have been on that train, they'd have been in the grave. And this rather saddened me, because I know that the world is a jungle and it's the survival of the fittest. And even today, to think that after putting all that service in the way I did, and to risk what I did and come home, I was not given a job, because the first question was, where were you before? And when I told them that I had 4.5 years in the army, they said, well, you're lacking in experience. And it was extremely difficult to get a job. Ultimately, I got a job by my own efforts and on my own personality, no push from anybody, and eventually I went on, and I managed to, ultimately, I was a leader of men in the army, and I became a leader of men out of the army. But I must say that today, after having the most wonderful wife any man could be fortunate enough to have, and 40 years of wonderful marriage, I lost my wife 2 years ago, and although we'd been married for 40 years, we not had an illness between us, she died in 33 days. And after her death, I was automatically classed and taxed as a single individual after being married and losing an allowance of £21 odd and being brought down to one of £9.50. And today my pension is £13.92 a week, and I have to put bank £10 of that myself in order to meet ever-rising bills which come in, and the crippling rate tax, the council rate, is something which, to my mind, should be evenly spread and not be given by to a few, because I only made my way and managed to get a property of my own, a very modest one, I suppose, but nonetheless a property. And I've been taxed ever since I've retired. I'm in my 81st year now, and I've paid taxes ever since I retired in 1961. My superannuation has not moved at all, And I have to stand helplessly by and watch my money shrinking, the few pounds that I have, and the bills getting ever bigger and bigger. And it's not a question of social security, and because that department should have been scrubbed years ago, because what it does, it fawns on parasites and frowns on patriots. And although I've never ever bothered to take anything from social security, and you know, I wouldn't even do it now, at long last I've been compelled and humiliated by having to ask the local council to allow me a rate rebate because it's so high that I can't see myself having anything to do but dig into what little money I have left. And when I think that after doing what I did and putting my life on the line, I consider that all my colleagues who were there and myself, we should at least be free of tax, if only for the fact that we did what we did.